Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, my name's Stuart Miles and welcome to the Apocalypse Podcast. Peloton previously announced Guide back in November 2021 and is now introducing the TV-connected camera designed for strength training to the UK, US, Canada and Australia. Apocalypse editor Chris Hall was at the UK launch this week and is here to tell us more. Meanwhile, I've been catching up with John Lau, a previous podcast interviewee, if you've been listening for some time, who's been working on the recently released Monument Valley 2 Plus and is here to talk about Apple Arcade, how games are changing, and whether there's going to be a Monument Valley 3 anytime soon. And then Chris comes back to talk about the new Tesla Model Y. He's been driving the crossover electric vehicle and is here to tell us whether it's any good. But before we talk cars, Chris, let's talk exercise, and in particular Peloton. And it's probably best to start by explaining what Guide actually is and how it's different from the exercise equipment we've seen from the company to date.
Yeah, so Peloton Guide is a new entry, and Peloton are pitching this as their cheapest hardware, so their cheapest way to access the Peloton system. It reminded me very much of the old Kinect from the Xbox. It is a connected camera. You plug it into your TV. And it's a nice, compact, fabric-wrapped, modern-looking device, as everything seems to be fabric-wrapped these days, and Peloton Guide is no different. It's a 4K wide-angle camera. It can then watch you as you exercise, which sounds a bit creepy, but it's not. And that means that there is an additional degree of interactivity when it comes to doing some of Peloton's guided workouts. And as you'll no doubt know from Peloton's bikes and the treadmill, the company is all about you finding a workout program that you want to do and watching and following along with somebody else who encourages you and talks to you while all of your stats are being tracked alongside all of this. The thing that Guide does is use that camera to check how your body is moving, to make sure that you're actually doing the exercises you're supposed to be doing, and sort of keep track of what you're doing that way.
And that, as you said, that sounds very much like Microsoft Kinect with that skeletal kind of overlay that it used to have to work out where you were so you could wave your hands at it and stuff like that. Is it that simple in the sense of it's looking at, you know, you've got to be in front of the TV, it looks at how you're moving, and then give you advice from there?
Yes and no. But what it really seems to be doing is looking at the overall form of your movement so it can recognize. If you're supposed to be doing a squat and you decide to do a dumbbell curl, it knows that you're not doing the right movement. And that's what it's really doing. But the clever thing is that you don't have to count your reps. You don't have to keep up. You don't have to keep in time with the instructor if you don't want to. You can go faster or slower, as you might do in any class. But what it does is it can detect that movement and it will keep score of things. So basically it gives you a target to hit to say this is the number of actions that you should be doing. This is how many reps of this exercise you should be doing. So it doesn't go quite as far as Kinect, which was able to detect individual limb movements and things like that, because I remember using it for dancing games where you could have a whole collection of people dancing and it would be able to track all of that. So it doesn't seem to have gone quite that far. It might go that way in the future. That sort of remains to be seen. At the moment, it's really about saying you're supposed to be doing a lunge and you're just standing on one leg, therefore you're not doing the exercise, so you get no credits for this. You're a very bad boy for not working out properly.
Now, I presume because it taps into the Peloton classes, it's the same sort of Peloton experience that if you are aware of the exercise bikes or treadmills and you've had a go or you've got friends that have a go, you know, really upbeat, let's go Peloton, get excited, shouting at you.
Yeah, it's very like that. And that's actually one of the things that I think is attractive about it. And that I think that's one of the reasons for Peloton's success is that there is a variety of instructors offering a variety of workouts. And as you say, the motivation is constantly there. They're always talking to you. And the most amusing thing is that they'll ask you questions. And obviously you don't reply because you're standing in your front room and you're not actually there and they can't hear you, but they give you the opportunity to reply to these questions, which is much more like a real life gym experience where you're working out with an instructor in a guided session. It's a kind of replication of that thing. Obviously, this doesn't involve the bike or the treadmill. So it's a bit like extracting some of the bootcamp experience that already exists in Peloton and making it into a guided workout. It's really about focusing on strength training here. You will need some basic equipment. You'll need some dumbbells and things like that so that you can do some of these resistant training. There is quite a lot of body weight actions in there, as well as guidance through things like warm-ups and cool-downs and stretching and lots of activities. And that's the thing that's really going to appeal to people, is that there's a lot of variety in there and it is very upbeat and you are encouraged and motivated all the way through.
Now, you were able to go to the launch. You've, from what I can gather, you've actually done a guide session.
Yeah, I have indeed, yes.
What was it like? Did you feel pumped and excited at the end, or did you think it's a quick fad that will tire?
I actually enjoyed it a lot more than I thought I was going to, and that surprised me, myself. I've done some guided workout stuff before. Like, it's so easy to find workouts on YouTube, and I have used those in the past, but this is a step above that. It's higher quality. It's sort of bespoke content. There are familiar instructors there. The enthusiasm, even if you're miserable like me, the enthusiasm just keeps you going. And it's also amazing that these instructors can constantly talk whilst doing all of this exercise, and you're sweating and you're panting and gasping for water, and they're just chatting away like it's an average day for them. So yes, I did two sessions. I did a chest and back session, and then I did a glutes and legs session, because I thought I may as well have most of the body workout whilst I'm there. These were both 10-minute sessions. There are longer sessions. It's a great thing for those people who don't want to go to the gym, who are embarrassed because perhaps they don't think that they fit in, or they don't like other people, or they don't like queuing for equipment, or they are just intimidated by the whole experience, then it gives those people a chance to do some of this stuff at home. And also, it's going to appeal to people who are time poor, because going to the gym is great, but going to the gym also includes traveling to the gym, getting changed, doing all that stuff. In this case, it's in your front room. You can just do it. You get home from work, you just say, I'm just going to go straight into this. Or for all of the people who are now working at home, it's ideal. You can cram in your workout in the lunchtime without having to leave the house at all.
And finally, do you think, based on all that, it sounds like a positive experience so far, do you think this is going to be a success for Peloton?
Yes, I think it is. But I think that it will have the same problems that other fitness products do, which is that a lot of people are enthusiastic about things and then they have a problem maintaining that. That's the same across the whole of the gym industry. It happens with, you know, all this indoor equipment that people buy, that they use it for a few months and then they stop, or they get bored, or they give up. And I think that it will still suffer from that experience. It's worth noting here that you have to pay for the camera in the first place, which is £295 or $275 in the US. But then you have to pay an ongoing subscription as well. And that will start in the UK at £24 and then go up to £39 in 2023. And it's worth noting that £39 is the same as the subscription you'd pay if you were a Peloton bike owner. If you do have a Peloton bike, you can buy the guide and you're already a subscriber, so you don't then have to pay anything else. So if you're already in the Peloton ecosystem and you want to do more strength training with more guidance, then yeah, pay your money by the camera and you can dive straight into it.
Still to come, Chris gives us his verdict on the Tesla Model Y.
The long range offers 331 miles of range and will do 0-60 in 4.8 seconds, which is a substantial range and impressive performance by any measure in electric vehicles. When you step up to the performance, you're still getting about 320 miles of range, but that the 0-60 speed comes down to 3.5 seconds, which it's funny that when we look at these speeds, you don't really think very much, but 3.5 seconds is actually incredibly fast, scarily fast.
When Apple Arcade launched in 2019, its pitch was simple. Deliver a monthly game service for iPhone, iPad and Mac users that would give them a range of games to play without having to worry about spending any more money beyond the monthly subscription, nor be bombarded with ads. Almost 3 years later, has the company delivered on that promise? Has it changed the type of games we play? And how does it fare against other gaming services on other platforms offering something similar? Wanting to find out more, I caught up with John Lau, a senior producer at Us2 Games. The games developer has been key to the Apple Arcade offering to date, with a number of titles available on the service, including the recently announced and added, hugely successful Monument Valley 2 game. I started by asking John what was different with the new version of Monument Valley 2 Plus on Apple Arcade.
Well, so the first thing I should say is that I wasn't around for the initial launch of Monument Valley 2, which was back in 2017, but I was a producer on bringing Monument Valley 2 to Apple Arcade, so Monument Valley 2 Plus. And so that initial launch really is just for Apple Arcade subscribers, and it includes both Monument Valley 2 and the additional chapter called The Lost Forest, which we completed for the Green Game Jam. So really, it's just a kind of porting of the Monument Valley 2 that you see on the App Store over to the Apple Arcade platform.
Now, a lot of people, you could argue that Monument Valley is kind of a game that was kind of designed for Apple Arcade, Apple's subscription model, you know, of gaming, before even Apple realized that it wanted a subscription model for gaming, just because of the kind of almost serendipitous type of play that involves. Do you think that fits? Do you think that's a good description? Does that fit well? Or do you think there are specific games that are destined for Apple Arcade that I haven't described there?
Yeah, interesting. So I think that at first blush, Monument Valley and Monument Valley 2 gameplay tend to be thought of as kind of, you know, one and done experiences, right? Mm. Like they're very beautiful hours of your life. And, you know, you play them once through and that's kind of it, really, I think. Like they're kind of thought of as beautiful artifacts in their own right. And so on that reading, you would think to yourself, well, for a subscription service, like, you know, how does that kind of, does that really work? I'm not really sure. Like, you know, that's not necessarily the kind of content that you would initially really think that would do well for subscription-based services, right?
Sure.
But what's interesting is that if you think about, well, firstly, we've seen that there are many, many players out there who just kind of return to Monument Valley and Monument Valley 2 as they would return a good book, right? Like, you know, after a certain amount of time, you just kind of want to be in that world again. And it doesn't really matter that you solved the puzzles before, because they kind of seem to come to you afresh, which is really lovely. But also, I think things like Apple Arcade and subscription services in general, when you think of them as building up a library of titles, as a series of games that you have access to whenever you like. The way I'd like to think about the Monument Valley games is kind of as kind of classic titles, in a way, if that's something that we can say ourselves, modern classics, if you will. And so that's something that you can, you know, that is just in your library, like an old and a familiar and beloved book that is on a shelf, sure, and then you pick off the shelf after a while.
And do you find that's the same, this sort of, that approach with, as you said, it's kind of these classics that you like to return to, and that. Apple Arcade feels like it is games that are slightly, be careful not to annoy publishers that aren't on there, but it feels that it's slightly more artistic and artisan in their approach. Do you feel that Monument Valley and some of the Us2 games, you know, fit into that marker? They've always had that kind of sort of artisanal kind of feel to them, rather than, you know, the ad heavy you know, buy every single token you can to just, you know, gain extra revenue and things like that.
Right. Yeah. So okay, so there are kind of two things I want to respond to in that question. The first is the general aesthetic of Us2 Games, or the kind of creative intention of Us2 Games in general, right? And it feels like there's a premium, you know, Us2 Games made their name with Monument Valley and a premium model, which is there is a particular aesthetic, gameplay vision, mechanical vision, an artistic vision for a game that you pay for up front. And this is the best game that we can make. You know, do you want to play it? Okay, please, you know, please buy it and enjoy. And that, I think, allows for a certain kind of attitude to the kind of creativity that comes to what you're making.
Mm.
And so in that sense, yes, that, like, you know, Us Two Games titles and back catalogue do seem to fit into that way of thinking. As to the point, part of the question, which is, do subscription models like Apple Arcade emphasize that rather than what you kind of describe as, you know, buy as many tokens as you can, all that kind of stuff? Are they an effective antidote to that? Oh, antidote, I don't want to say antidote, but like, are they a different way of monetizing games or allowing players to access games? I think the answer is kind of. I think, well, the thing is, Stuart, I think you and I have actually spoken before about the way in which content or media is affected by the way in which it's funded, right? Yeah. I think the last time you and I spoke, I went on a long diatribe about sitcoms and
agreed.
Yeah. You know,
well remembered.
Well, it was. I really enjoyed that conversation. So the thing is, when free to play was the dominant form, the profit incentive really, when you're making a video game, if you're a studio, the profit incentive is to design games in a very particular way, which is to encourage as many small purchases as possible. Right? That's not necessarily the choice that every studio takes, but it is definitely what the profit incentive points you towards. Now, subscription based models have changed that. And so you can be said to be moving away from buying as many tokens as you can. But it is still about retention. It's about getting players to come back. So I think whilst it'll be a while yet until we're able to see how that affects video game design, like in a broader sense, I'd say that is the kind of game that Apple Arcade and subscription-based services will incentivize more. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it is that question, isn't it? Of whether there's two questions that come out of that. One is, do you think that we'll move to a future, you know, especially with a recent announcement on a console level that Sony is now getting into Sony PlayStation Plus, and they're really going to double down on that against Microsoft's, you know, Xbox Games Pass. You know, you're seeing that the big consoles are going down this subscription model of his 300, 400, 700 titles to play to bring new life to those classics that, you know, is either a nostalgia play or something you might not have played for a while and you can still play and enjoy. Or it's that, you know, and therefore, do we think that that's where the industry is going to go for the next couple of years? And that will be with apps as well. You know, Monument Valley isn't the first Apple Arcade game that Us Two has, but there are still games within the Us Two catalog, like the classic Whale Trail from all those years ago, that aren't yet on Apple Arcade.
Well, so if the question is, do we think that that's where the video games industry is going to be? I think, like, signs certainly seem to, as you say, point in that direction. And like I said, I'm not sure it's necessary. It's, well, put it this way. Subscription as a model is definitely here to stay as a way of consuming games. It's not going anywhere. It might not necessarily be the be all and end all. It might not, like, you know, something else might come along. It's very likely to come along, actually. I also think what I'm most interested in is, now that that is starting to bed in as a model for funding games, how does that affect the kind of games that get made? Like, what changes do we see as a consequence of that in the design of video games? And we're yet to kind of see that, I think.
Yeah. Now, last time I spoke to you, you were with a different games company, with State of Play, and we were talking about South of the Circle. Did you, and now you're here at Us Too, do you feel that as an industry that's, you know, they were both very beautiful games, very artistic and in that approach. Is that something that appeals to you, or do you hope to help Us to create even more kind of storytelling and artistic telling in the same vein?
Me personally? Well, yeah. I mean, I think my, personally, as a game maker and someone who works on games, what I'm most interested in is the ways in which games as a medium provide a new and interesting language for storytelling. And that was something that we were exploring on South the Circle, and it's definitely something that like Us Two Games has shown is absolutely possible with the amount of the way in which you emotionally engage with the characters in Monument Valley and the Monument Valley games. And so I think I'm definitely interested in seeing how we can bring about emotional responses in our players and connection with characters and connection with ideas, whether those ideas are about, motherhood and growing up in Monument Valley 2, or forgiveness in Monument Valley 1, or engagement with environmental issues and kind of grassroots activism in Alba. I think there are absolutely ways in which there are unexplored ways in which games can do that and do it very effectively. I'd love to get into that at Us Two. I think it's already being done, and I'm just excited to do more of it.
And I have to ask the question, Do you think there'll be a Monument Valley 3?
So I couldn't tell you any specifics, Joe, but I am, we are currently staffing up for the next installment of the Monument Valley series. So that's kind of all I'll say. There'll be another installment of Monument Valley. That's pretty much about it.
And while we wait with a bated breath of that, because that sounds really exciting, as a fan of both the original game and the new game, the new chapter within the, as you said, Monument Valley 2 Plus, as you're calling it, for Apple Arcade. So that has a new Lost Forest chapter.
Yes.
How much fun was that? And what are the challenges of that to kind of come back to it a couple of years later?
Oh, yeah. I mean, so big shoes to fill, obviously. As I said, I didn't work on the original Monument Valley 2, but coming on to the project when the team was gearing up to make that extra chapter, which was our response to the Green Game Jam organized by Playing for the Planet. I think it's obviously quite a frightening, worrying thing, to be walking in those footsteps. But I think, as with anything which is much beloved and highly regarded, I think there is absolutely a line to be walked between doing due justice to what's come before and also to trying to do something new with it, right? I think there is a quote somewhere about tradition and how tradition is not the worshipping of ashes, but the preservation of fire. And I think there's something about that when it comes to evolving or elaborating on the ideas and themes and images and feelings that are brought about from a much beloved set of experiences like Monument Valley 1 and 2. And that's kind of what we wanted to do.
And so I know you've alluded to you're working on some new projects within that. The final question I have is what's next for both you and for Us Two Games?
What's next? Well, I'm just thinking about what I can actually talk about. Lots.
Tell us. We won't tell it from too many people. It's okay.
What's next? Well, I think... From my perspective, there's another Monument Valley game in the works, and that's what I can tell you. And I think we're currently in concepting with that, and we are like in full development with that, and trying to do the absolute trying to walk that line between doing something new and preserving what's gone before us. And there's also I believe I can say this, another Us Two Games in the that's in the works, but the precise details of that are not something I can go into, unfortunately.
See, there here's me hoping that it's Whale Trail Plus.
Yeah.
I think it was one of Us Two's first games, I think, at the time. That was a very, very long time ago. And just the concept of running, playing with this whale, it's one of those games I keep on coming back to occasionally.
I mean, sure, it's the simple ideas that stick, right?
Sitting in between the Tesla Model 3 and the Tesla Model X is the Model Y. From the exterior, it looks much like the Model 3, but while offering the size that's closer to the Model X. So, is it the best of both worlds, or in trying to be something between the two, does it, well, just not really work? Good news is Chris is back, and he's been driving the new EV to find out. So, what's it like, Chris?
Well, the Tesla Model Y sits in a space that should probably be its most attractive vehicles. It's in that crossover or small compact SUV space, and that's where most of those cars are being sold, especially in Europe. So for the UK market, and I'm driving it in the UK, UK spec model, then I think it's a key car. As right. You said, it looks a lot like the Tesla Model 3, but it's kind of been inflated. Everything is slightly bigger than the Model 3.
Yeah, because when I've seen pictures previously, I just thought, oh, it's a Model 3 with a hatch rather than the saloon back.
Yeah, I think a lot of the photographs that you see, especially the original press images, have been quite deceptive because they're always taken at a sort of low, sporty angle. You know, you don't quite appreciate how high the car is. And the ride height is much higher. So you sit in it and you look around and you're looking over the roof of smaller cars like the Model 3, for example. Right. But the experience is very much the same, though, because the interior design is basically exactly replicated. The seats, the interior, the display, the user interface, steering wheel, the whole minimalist aesthetic that you get inside is exactly the same as the Model 3. And the good thing about that is that the Model 3 has been extremely popular. And so the Model Y will inevitably follow along in that, you know, everything. If you love anything about the Model 3, you'll love it about the Model Y. There's one big barrier, though, I think, and that is that the Model Y in the UK starts at £54,000, which is quite a step over the Model 3. And you're looking at that very same experience. So people might say, well, you get a little bit more interior space, but what else am I actually paying for? And I think when you compare it to some of the rivals that you have on the roads, like those cars from Audi or perhaps BMW, Mercedes, there is a big difference in quality of the interior. Obviously, those older established brands are still using interiors that reflect their combustion cars that have evolved over many, many years. But there's a lot more going on in those interiors compared to Tesla. And I mean, Tesla's whole thing is about being minimalist. And so some people will want that, whereas there will be some people who won't want that. And for those people who don't want it, there are alternatives.
And in terms of performance and range, et cetera, that, is it equivalent to the Model 3, or have they taken advantage of the bigger size?
Yeah, well, they're selling the long range and the performance. And so the long range offers 331 miles of range and will do 0-60 in 4.8 seconds, which is a substantial range and impressive performance by any measure in electric vehicles. When you step up to the performance, you're still getting about 320 miles of range, but that the 0-60 speed comes down to 3.5 seconds, which is it's funny that when we look at these speeds, you don't really think very much, but 3.5 seconds is actually incredibly fast, scarily fast.
Yes.
So fast that you probably never really even want to use it on the roads. This is drag strip sort of stuff. And, you know, as you'll know, because I know that you have a Model 3, yeah, within the settings, you can change the acceleration. And I changed it to chill fairly early on just because I needed things to relax a little bit. I needed the Tesla Model Y just to calm down slightly and make sure that I didn't leave the road at any point.
Of, when we've got, you know, guests, passengers in that have never sat in a Model 3 before, we kind of, we call it the giggle seat, because if you put your foot down when they're not expecting it, they instantly start laughing because they don't know what else to do.
Yeah.
And I know one of a friend has got a Model S, and he's got the performance model. He's too afraid to go off and try and buy ludicrous mode or plaid or whatever they want to call it these days. But because he kind of describes it as a teleporter, it's like, I'd like to be over there. Oh, look, I'm over there.
Yeah.
So from that perspective, and I think the other thing that's quite crazy about Tesla on that side of things is that if you get the standard model, and I presume this is the same with the Model Y, then you can upgrade to the performance model at the press of a button within the app. and pay your £1,500 upgrade fee or whatever it is. So, which is quite, again, like, just be careful of thinking, oh yeah, that sounds great, let's press the button.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think the important things that are really attractive about Tesla, I mean, we've just talked about range and performance, and this is impressive range. The charging infrastructure through supercharger network is unrivaled. It is clearly better than the other options that are on the road at the moment. The fact that you can pull over and you'll see 12 superchargers while the other networks will only have one or two chargers and they may not be fast. That makes a massive difference. The fact that the car knows where those are and can precondition the battery before you get there. All of these little points, the fact that you plug it in and you don't have to press any buttons or authenticate, you just plug it in and then you're charged. All of that makes living with a Tesla much smoother than living with other types of electric car. Now, if you're charging at home, which a lot of people do, then that becomes less important in your day-to-day driving. But certainly in long-range driving, that makes a big difference. The other thing that I should say about Model Y is that because it's bigger, it does have quite a large capacity in the boot.
Right.
And it's deceptive, though, because as you highlighted, it has a slightly different back to the Model 3. And everything is open and there's no parcel shelf. And I find that really strange for a car, especially in the UK, where the mantra is don't leave anything on site, because if you do, you'll have it stolen from your car.
Yeah.
So the fact that there's no parcel shelf would kind of lead you down the line of saying, well, you can't really leave anything in the boot of your car because somebody will be able to see it. But there is a false floor and you lift it up and there's quite a cavernous space underneath. So you could fit quite a lot of stuff underneath the floor out of sight. But I still think in...
And presumably you've got the front trunk as well.
Oh yeah, there is the small front trunk if you really, really want to hide things out of the way. But yeah, I do feel like the lack of a parcel shelf is a strange thing because it just feels like there's a big space there that could just do with covering, so that if you've put anything in the back of the car, you've got cases in the back or whatever.
And the final question, I suppose, presumably unlike the Model X, the back seats can fold.
Yes.
To produce quite a big space. And is it a flat? Does it fold flat so you've got a decent
Honestly, I don't know if it is completely flat. I did fold them down. There's little buttons to in the back to just release them and fold them down. I can't remember if it's completely flat, but it's flat enough. So it's a useful space. If you needed to, I don't know, take some stuff to the rubbish tip or
move a child into university or something.
Yeah, if you need to do those sorts of things, then it does have the flexibility to do all of that stuff. So it is surprisingly practical.
Well, that's it for this week's show. Until next time, thanks for listening. Pip, pip.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.